Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Truly the sun and fun capital of the world today. It was beautiful out in a crisp 78 degrees. We could not have had a more beautiful fall day in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. It's great to have everybody with us. We got a wonderful guest and co-host is going to be here with us, joining us as we go along. We've got the Surgeon General of Scarycast, the one and only, the venerable Dr. Trey Dunaway. How are you doing tonight, Trey?
John, I've never been called venerable. This is a red letter day for me. Thank you very much for acknowledging my venerability. Venerationable ability.
Okay.
Whatever.
That is a compliment, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought, golly.
And you don't need to venerate me. You don't need to venerate me right now. We can save it for later if there's time.
Okay, great. We'll do a whole show on that. Okay. Well, that's wonderful.
Veneration.
We're glad to have you here. And the queen of Scarycast, the one and only Robin McCray is here. How are you doing tonight, Robin?
I am good. I am so sorry I'm late, you guys. As John knows, I work with and I help a lot of people. And I've had several new people in the last week. And so it was a last-minute thing that somebody needed my help with. So I do apologize. I'm so sorry.
No, that's all right. You're right on time. So we're glad to have you here. It's another red-letter day for Scarycast. It's October, our favorite month. And we've got one of our favorite guests with us tonight. From, let's say near Clarksville, Tennessee. We have the one and only Elijah Henderson. Elijah, how are you doing tonight?
My friend, I'm doing great tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderfully. And so in case you don't know out there in radio land, that's an old phrase, but in radio land, if you don't know, Elijah Henderson's family were some of the first and most thorough explorers of the land between the lakes, which is truly one of the most frightening paranormal areas in the whole world. Got lots of Dogman, lots of Bigfoot, lots of ghosts, lots of everything, and they've explored it. They saw a lot, they recorded a lot, and Elijah is quite a videographer, and he puts up a lot of videos on his page. And now, Elijah, first of all, tell us, what is your YouTube channel so everybody can go there and check it out?
Well, my organization is called Cryptid Studies Institute. We're based out of Clarksville, Tennessee, and basically our YouTube channel will be under the same name, our Facebook, our Instagram, but we do a lot of documentaries on different subjects around Appalachian Mountains, over this way, closer to around Clarksville, Tennessee, Beast of LBL, Werewolf Springs. We do a lot of stuff in this area. And, I'd be honored if y'all went around and checked out our work.
I have, and it is wonderful. You're quite a fine videographer. And look, thanks for being here with us. I wanted to talk to you tonight. I am in the middle of a wonderful project with our buddy John LeMay. It is a project, it's a book called Bloodsuckers, and it's about a variety of blood-sucking animals or whatever that leave their prey dry of blood, and that was kind of an epidemic, and it spanned from North Carolina, it dipped a little south toward Texas, and came up toward the Los Angeles area, and the years that occurred were between the late 1920s and the early 1960s. And what tipped us off is we were doing a show about the Bladenboro Monster. And Bladenboro is about 30 miles north of me, north of Myrtle Beach, and they even have a festival. It's really interesting. And then we started talking, and we started brainstorming on that episode of Scarycast, and we came up with the fact that there are a lot of bloodsuckers from the chupacabra all the way over there in New Mexico, Arizona, and California to those in Texas and Missouri, Arkansas, some in Tennessee, and then, of course, the Bladenborough Monster. And there are a lot of recorded newspaper clippings about them. So that kind of prompted John and I to start putting a book together, and I'm looking forward to it. It's a lot of fun working with him and everything. So that's kind of the impetus of this whole thing. And so I was talking with Elijah, about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and I said, you know, Elijah, I wanted to know about shapeshifters up there in the Tennessee area, because I'm sure if there are any, you know about them. And you said, well, yeah, John, I do kind of know what's going on there. So I asked you to be on the show tonight and talk a little bit about the shapeshifters. Now, Robin, you have had experience with shapeshifters, haven't you?
Yes. Absolutely.
Right. And I saw a shapeshifter here in that went into the building behind my building here at 500 Oak Circle Drive in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I saw one. And so it was just amazing. In fact, I was talking to Robin McCray on the phone when it happened.
That's weird, you're talking to me.
I know, and I couldn't believe it. This boy, he was looked to be about 25 years old. He walked directly through a door. I said, oh, my God, Robin, this boy just walked through a door. He didn't open it. And, I mean, I wasn't standing 60 feet from it. I saw the thing, and I've never seen anything that creepy and that strange. So, yes, I believe they exist from my little experience there. So now, Elijah, tell us about the shapeshifters up there in the LBL, the Land Between the Lakes area, which is in southeastern Kentucky, spanning over toward Nashville and your area of Clarksville. So tell us a little bit about the shapeshifters that you found or have experienced over there.
Well, one historical story, I only know of one or two shapeshifter stories from this area, but I have heard of multiple around the country and around the world before. Specifically, Land Between the Lakes, as people know, it's pretty famous for the Beast of LBL. You know, I'm sure many people have heard about the story of that family for getting attacked and killed in 1982 by something large and bestial. And that hinges on urban legend and truth, and I believe it was truth. And, you know, a lot of details of it over time have become kind of convoluted, so to speak. But I do believe that happened. But one of the stories, I can't say if it's true or false because I wasn't there, I don't know. But one of the early accounts from the area, it's a bit of lore from the area, so to speak, was that the beast was basically the spirit of a Shawnee medicine man, as the story goes, it was like the spirit of a shape-shifting Shawnee shaman. He was killed in wolf form by the inhabitants of his village for abusing his powers, and that's one aspect of the legend, what people say it is, that his spirit is walking through the woods now. Now, I don't actually believe in ghosts. I believe in demonic entities that impersonate spirits of the dead, but, you know, it wouldn't be hard for something like that to do the same thing. It could easily be possible. But that is one shape-shifting story from Land Between the Lakes, an origin story, so to speak, of the beast.
Well, now let me ask you something real quickly. Are the Shawnee Indians, I take it, I hope this is the correct way to use the word, they are indigenous to that area, southeastern Kentucky and northeastern Tennessee, correct?
I'm going to assume at one time they were. I'm going to be honest, I don't know for sure. I'd hate to say for certain because it'd be only speculation on my part. But I would assume they were.
Okay, and so there was a story. Do we have any particulars of that story?
Not a whole lot of information on that aspect, but that part of the story does float around from time to time. Essentially, I know this isn't the proper term because it's out west, but essentially a skinwalker of the Shawnee tribe being killed in wolf form and his spirit wandering the land. I guess perhaps he swore revenge or just his spirit came back because he is killed in wolf form. And I'll be honest, I'm not exactly sure where that story comes from, but another researcher was telling me that there is a family around LBL, not sure who they are, not sure where they live, but he heard that part of the community over there believes this family is legitimately werewolves and that they can shapeshift and change, and that's what the Beast of LBL is, this family of so-called werewolves. Now, is that true? I couldn't hazard a guess, but it definitely makes for an interesting story in retelling.
Okay. Yeah, and one question that I've got, I'm sorry for this kind of going so weird, but we hear stories about werewolves, humans turning into bipedal, wolf-like creatures that are ferocious. We hear about werewolves all over. And now, do you think, because you're over there in that area, do you think the werewolves are related to the dogmen, those legendary ferocious creatures? And from what I understand, there are a lot of deaths that have been attributed in LBL, which is Land Between the Lakes, which is a large national park. There are a number of deaths that have been attributed to dogman. Is that correct?
There are a lot of deaths and disappearances that have been connected to it. By our count and the count of another gentleman, I believe he said it was 18 or 19. We counted 15 on our own, by our own research, of deaths or disappearances that seem to be connected to the Beast of LBL. And this other gentleman, his name's Martin Gross. He's a former law enforcement gentleman. I think he said 18 or 19. So, yes, there is certainly the presence of something violent in the area, and I don't know. It could easily be some sort of shape-shifting thing, I guess, if that's possible. Now, there have been sightings of a mother dog man with three pups running across the road, so I feel like there's at least something physical legitimate in the area, because that would indicate a reproductive cycle, that it's breeding and reproducing real healthy in the LBL. But that's not to say that something else isn't going on as well, because, you know, my dad is one up there, and he's found where people are actively doing witchcraft in the woods up there, and he was geocaching in the middle of the night. I know that probably sounds weird, but him and a friend of ours, family friend of ours, used to like go geocaching, and I honestly do not know the spot where he was at. I wasn't there at the time.
Now,
I was very little.
First of all, I'm going to stop you. What is geocaching?
Oh, okay. Geocaching, let's see, how do I describe this? Basically, people take a GPS, and there's these different little location points, and they may be different things. There's actually a Beast of LBL geocache up there somewhere, but when you find these spots, it'll be like a little canister, and it'll have a notepad. You write your name down, and it's essentially, hey, I found this spot, and there may be little trinkets in a bag inside the canister, and you'd take something out and replace it with something else. It's a game of sorts, a hobby for people. But they were up there doing it one night, and the area I did get to visit like years later, because we just happened to be in the same spot. It kind of goes up a hill, and then the trail kind of is a little bit circular, so to speak. That's a terrible description, but anyway, up on top of this hill, they walked up there, and they had a bunch of fiery torches up there and some sort of an altar made. And when he got up there, all these people, I think he said they're in robes even, ran off into the woods. And my dad, he was as Christian as they come. He went over and kicked their altar over and left. And he described to me that when he went back down the hill, him and his friend, he seen him in the woods, and they came up to him and said, "Oh, we knew you were coming. We were just trying to scare you." "No, you weren't. You were just off doing something you shouldn't have been in the woods up there." I mean, but there is witchcraft that goes on up in the LBL, and I haven't contacted him yet, more than just a couple of Facebook messages. I still got to call him on the phone. But there was a gentleman telling me something to the effect of legitimate satanic werewolf, so to speak, through the agency of demonic spirits, being able to transform somebody into a werewolf, a legitimate werewolf. And he'd mentioned that there had been some rituals that went on in LBL. So I think that's going to be a very interesting conversation when I get in touch with him.
When did this happen?
Okay.
I'm sorry?
When did this happen?
Well, the gentleman wrote me a couple of weeks ago, and I just haven't actually talked to him on the phone yet, but I've exchanged a couple of messages online with him. I'm not exactly sure of the year that he said all this went down.
Gotcha.
Now, as for my dad geocaching, that would have been about maybe 2005, I think, because he had a heart attack, and it was just like a week or two after that he got back in the woods. And yeah, he was doing things right after a heart attack he shouldn't have been, but I believe it's 2005 that stuff was going on.
All right.
Sorry, say that again. I'm going to ask Robin actually to comment after you finish, and then I'm going to kind of tell everybody some research that I've been working on and how it kind of plays into this idea of people doing rituals out in the woods and everywhere else. It's very, very interesting. Elijah, please continue to finish up that story, and then I'd like to have some comments from Robin.
Well, something I just kind of wanted to tack on to that conversation. I had mentioned that gentleman talking about satanic werewolves, so to speak. And there's a gentleman by the name of Bill Schneblin. I'm not sure if anybody's familiar with that name. But he's an author. He's got a lot of books out and whatnot. He describes that he used to be in a very dark branch of Satanism, a couple of different branches of the occult, a lot of different things he was involved in, he said. But he described that there's a branch you can take as you go up the ladder so far that you can literally, through the power of demonic agencies, be turned into a vampire or a werewolf. He said the vampire route was less painful because in werewolf form you'd shift and change and your bones would break. He heard it was very painful, but he wanted to inflict pain on people, so he went with the vampire route. And it wasn't quite as goofy as what Hollywood describes. You know, he said that you couldn't turn into a bat or mist or anything like that. But he did stay out of the sunlight, and he did drink blood. But as for the werewolf route, he said, yes, it's a very real thing. And
were there any other options? Could you just be a werewolf or a vampire? Were there other options you could opt for, or is it just those two?
In that particular branch, as far as I know, it was only vampirism and lycanthropy, you know, turned into a werewolf and whatnot. But, you know,
okay.
if you consider, like, Native American skinwalkers that could supposedly transform into multiple different animals, or even
right.
old witch stories where they could turn into anything they want, it's not to say that it was out of the realm of possibility. They could have turned into anything they wanted, but I
okay.
only heard him describe werewolf and vampirism.
Okay.
But there was another woman, I forget her name, I can get it to you later, John, but I have her book in the other room. She also came out of a very dark branch of Satanism. I think she called it the Brotherhood. And she described something very similar. She said that you can actually, through satanic agencies, turn into a werewolf. And she described the werewolves are completely devoted to Satan. They're wholly given out. You know, they're completely evil people. And she even included a story in there of a gentleman. I think he had done something to upset the cult they were in. And he'd had a .357 Magnum on him, and I guess they sentenced him to death, so to speak, and he pulled out that gun and started firing at this werewolf, and it didn't do anything, and they devoured him, you know, just tore him apart. And I can get you that lady's name later so you can look into it if you want, John.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, now... Robin, I would like for you to weigh in on what Elijah has said, because a lot of what Elijah is talking about has come from his experience and his pretty thorough knowledge of folklore up there in the area. What do you have to say about all this?
Well, he's covered a lot of ground, so I'm trying to pick out as he talking, I'm just kind of listening and taking mental notes, and now that you've asked me, I'm trying to remember everything. First of all, he's so on target with from what I know. I mean, I'm not saying he's not on target 100%. I'm saying from what I know, it really matches up, so to speak. Like, when he's talking about the black magic and that kind of stuff, you know, Tennessee has got spots all over it that have... dark magic that have been used. I got pulled into the Cumberland Mountains to clear off land that had that done to it. I also had to do that in Indiana. But it can take even the best cryptids or anything else, and when they get in those areas, it makes them worse. So then you go to the LBL, and a lot of the stuff that goes to the LBL and hangs out there does that because they're already bad, like really. And now they've got a stronghold there. But they go there to get away from everybody and to stay by themselves because they're bad and they don't like us. You know, and of course, we go in there and that causes the whole storm. So that, you know, I agree with him 100% on that. As far as, you know, what he's saying about the shape-shifting and stuff, I already know that that they're shape-shifters. Any cryptid out there can shape-shift. All your ETs can shape-shift. All your cryptids can shape-shift. All your dimensionals, all the elementals. All of these things have the ability to shapeshift. And then because that's not creepy enough, you get the ETs that literally take possession of people. And it's just like, you know, they use our human skins, but they're inside of it. And, you know, I've had that happen to me. I've been attacked by these things. So all that stuff, I mean, I just think it's everything he's saying is so spot on. Like, it's really impressive. It's very interesting. And it's real. You can't dispute the reality that this stuff actually goes on. As far as the ones that drink the blood and do all that, you know, I'm not going to say that doesn't happen. That's not something that I deal with a lot. I would never say that anybody's wrong, because in this world I've learned one thing, that nothing is impossible. Now, I had a few people that contacted me, this was years ago, and this one guy claimed he wasn't a werewolf. He absolutely claimed he was a werewolf. Said that, you know, every night he would, you know, when the moon was full and this would happen and he drank blood and he did, was he telling the truth? I don't know. I mean, I never met him in person. It's possible he was being honest. You know, he seemed very off balance at the time, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't real or that these things weren't happening. Now, I have dogmen at my house. I also have a werewolf at my house. The werewolf that's here, he doesn't transform. He is what he is. He's also not aggressive. He's also kind. He's massive, but he's very nice. But again, that doesn't mean that these other things aren't possible. So, I mean, as far as my opinion on it, my opinion is that I think that any of this stuff is entirely possible. And when you have somebody that has extensively researched this, like Elijah has, I tend to put my faith in that. He's going to know what he's researching. He's done the background. He's done all of these things. You know, I applaud that. I really do. And I think that the information he brings forward is incredible and extremely interesting. But as far as the witchcraft and that kind of stuff goes, that taints the ground. And, you know, back when the Native Americans were more prominent, obviously, than what they are now, and before we did what we did to them, there was a lot of black magic. There was a lot of white magic. There was Native American, you know, magic, that kind of thing. It taints the ground. It absorbs into the ground. It can change the entire energy in the ground. And it's not that easy to change it. It can be done. I've done it. But it's not, you know, it's not like you take a cleaning crew in there and it's over and done with. And that will contribute to things that go on in that space.
Okay. That's very interesting. Now I would like, it's really interesting that we are talking right now about a subject I have been researching heavily for the last week. Now, Trey, do you remember when we had our show about the reticular activation system? Do you remember that?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Now I got to ask you something. I sent you an extremely rough draft. Have you? I hope you haven't read it. Have you not? I hope you have not.
I have not.
Good. Don't, because the next draft is going to be so much better. I probably spent about 12 hours researching the RAS, the Reticular Activation System. And I want to explain that, and then I want to talk about the phrase intent and how shamans look at the word intent and how they use that in creating magic, which I think is very, very appropriate for what we're talking about. The reticular activation system is, from what I understand, it's about the size of half a number two pencil, and it's back there in the brainstem, and it does two very important things. Number one, it controls the waking up and the explosion, as they call it, the explosion of the consciousness in our waking moments. That's pretty clear. And another thing that it does is it filters our reality. I mean, we get about about 2 billion bits of information a second. And we'd go crazy if we didn't have something to filter that out and let it focus on what we're doing. Now, Dr. Trey, am I kind of on the right path here?
Yes, John, but I've got to admit, I am a surgeon, and the worst class I did in medical school was neuroanatomy. So I don't know all the ins and outs of the reticular activating system, but I can tell you one thing. There's not a lot known about it because it's kind of tricky stuff.
That's true. But one of the things that seems to be known about it is that it filters out. It's like, here's an example. You can be a mother and you can live in an apartment in a busy city like New York City where it's noisy all the time, and you can learn to go to sleep. But if you have a child, you will wake up immediately if a mother who can sleep through anything in New York City can wake up in an instant if they hear their child screaming or crying. Now, Robin, you're a mother, and do you agree that you could sleep through anything, but when you heard one of your children squawk and upset, you were right.
Oh,
and so
I love while the noise
Pardon?
Is coming out of their mouth.
Right.
I'm up and
so
as soon as it starts to come out.
Right, and that's what I have learned about the reticular activating syndrome, the system. And it's like if you're driving from here to Memphis and you say you're going to get there by the evening and you're going to go off at a particular exit to get to your hotel, well, you're going to avoid looking at all of the exit signs until you get near Memphis. Then you're going to start noticing them, and you're going to be looking for exit number 22 or whatever it is. Because there's so much stimulus that comes into us. The reticular activating system, what it says, what the articles that I read say, it filters everything out. Now, here comes the most interesting thing. I'm a computer scientist, and I believe the brain is the most incredible supercomputer in the entire universe. I believe our brain is a quantum computer. I believe our brain can do things that we don't even know it can. And Trey, I believe you might agree with that, right? The brain
Although
is
some
all
people
powerful.
Don't use their brain very much. They're hardly used.
Okay, that's true. But, you know, so I'm a big believer in the power of the brain. So what I started looking for is I said, well, how can we program this supercomputer? Because my buddy Harvey told me about that he learned about the reticular activating system from a guy in a sales seminar 20 years ago. And the guy said, well, this is how you can actually use it to your advantage to help notice things that are important to you. Like in sales, if you want to go for a certain clientele, you should be able to train your reticular activating system so that it will help you look for them and recognize them. And Harvey told me that after I'd had a bad day. My story goes, I was looking for businesses that had 5 to 50 employees. I couldn't find any. I think in a stretch of about 15 miles of busy highway, I found 3 of them, and I felt very dejected. So I called Harvey. He told me the story about the reticular activating system. And I said, well, okay. So it was a Thursday evening, so I went home. And like I always do, if I really want to get my brain going, I lay down and meditate, and I think about the problem I'm trying to solve. And I said, well, how can I use it? What is it? I did a little bit of looking up, and I couldn't find much about it. So anyway, the next day, I drove along the same stretch of highway, and lo and behold, I found 40, and I listed them, over 40 different businesses that had between 5 and 50 employees. So I realized I had changed. Something had changed inside me. And so when I looked up and tried to learn a little bit about the reticular activating syndrome, it said that what it does is it filters out what you don't want from what you want. And then it sends what you want up to your cerebral cortex, which a lot of people would call the gray matter. Is that correct, Trey?
Well, yeah, roughly, sure.
Yeah, so it sends the things that you need to help yourself make decisions up there into the cerebral cortex, and you make better decisions, and you can notice things. Like another example is like in a room, noticing everything that's blue. If you think hard enough, you can start seeing all the blue things that you really didn't see before you thought about it. So that's another use of the reticular activating system. And Trey, I've still got a lot of learning to do, but that's a little bit, and I've seen a diagram, and basically everything travels up the reticular activating system to the hypothalamus, and that's from the hypothalamus, which is a little tiny spot in the brain, correct?
Correct.
And it just, and those signals go out to the gray matter of the cerebral cortex. That's probably grossly oversimplified, but that's what the articles that I read, it seems as though that's what happens. So now comes some discussion from one of the articles about a shaman, and he was meeting with a group of people that were interested in what he did. And one of the men said that he had just been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and he was not feeling good. And the shaman said, lay down on the ground. Let me see what I can do. And so the shaman stood and stared at him for a few minutes. then started dancing around him, started shaking some rattles, started pulling his hands up and down and all this. And the gentleman, after about an hour, the shaman said, stand up. And he stood up. He said, my goodness, I feel better. And the shaman said, when did you start feeling better? And he said, well, actually, right after you were staring at me for about 3 minutes. He said, so tell me what you did. He said, well, all that was just ceremony. It was just entertainment. What happened was I had the intent that I was going to heal you. And my intent healed you prior to all that window dressing. And I've got the book coming, Dr. Wayne Dyer, about intention. And apparently intention in the human mind is a very powerful thing. And when we look at programming our magnificent computers in our heads and programming that reticular activating system, it is the intent. And there are several verbs that have been used since the 30s. I've got them in books, some of my motivational books, since the 30s. And I'm beginning to find a pattern. There are people that use them, I believe, to train their reticular activating system, or they use them to program their brain. Now, I know, Dr. Trey, that's a big statement, but I'm trying to piece this all together. I'm a fair scientist. I went to NC State. They were pretty heavy on the science. They just said, you just have to know how to do it. And we had to know how to do it to get through that program. So it seems as though your intent can trigger responses from the reticular activating system that can help you notice things that you want to notice. So you're basically programming your brain. Now, I'm sorry. I hope that doesn't sound too far-fetched. And Dr. Trey, I'm going to have some good references. I want to make sure it passes your test for reasonableness, because you're our Surgeon General and you're the guy that knows science better than anybody I know. So I tell you what, if it's all right, we will save this conversation to a later time. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, good. And it's like, oh my God, what is John getting me into to listen to? But anyway, so that's what I'm thinking. So the whole point being is that a lot of this magic, I believe, has to do with the initial intent. And I can't wait to get Dr. Wayne Dyer's book about intention, and I'm looking for other books to see if magicians feel that their intent is more important than the ceremony. And even though they do lots of ceremonies, and I'm not so sure that those ceremonies are done by people that know what they're doing. They're people that have read about a ceremony and are doing it. Now, Robin McCray, in all my rambling here, what do you think about the statement that I just made, that it's not so much the ceremony as it is the original intent of the people? What do you think as really our psychic?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think if you even look back at any of the cryptids, you know, they are a different type of people. There are people. Cold, hard facts. There are people. They're not our type of people, but they are people. They read people, okay? They read their energy. They read everything. And a lot of times people don't understand why they react to them the way they do. You can't pull anything over on them because they know your intent. Everything is about your intent. When you put out gifts for them, you know, they're not supposed to take them, but they do. They do. But it depends on the clan, on what that clan will allow. But even when you leave a gift out, if they don't take it, it doesn't make it less important or less meaningful for them, because it's all about the intent. They read the intent. They react by the intent. I know somebody that went out in the woods. He's a wonderful guy. They always interact with them. He brought some people with him up to camp that time and got the strangest reaction. He couldn't understand why. And he's like, they were just like not really wanting to interact. They didn't want to have anything to do with us. So I asked him, and they said it wasn't him. It was his friend. And I said, well, what did he do? He didn't do anything. I said, what was wrong with him? It was his intent. his intent was not the same as the one that we consider a friend. It was the intent, and they read that intent. Intent has a lot to do with a lot of things.
Okay, so at least that notion that I have matches what you're familiar with, is that intent is very important.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a possibility that not only needs more research on it, but I don't think it should be discarded, because I think it's a very real possibility.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. I'm glad that I got your. I'm glad that I got some a little bit of initial approval there. And where this comes in, you know, we're talking about, you know, I asked Elijah to come on and talk about shapeshifters. Okay, so he told a story of a Shawnee medicine man, and he mentioned the shapeshifters out in Utah, and we're familiar with them at Land Between the Lakes. And what you're saying, Robin, is that these beings who are what we would call cryptids can read our intent, correct?
Absolutely, 100%.
In the same way that shapeshifters have the intent to shapeshift, correct?
I don't even think it's just that it's their intent to shapeshift. If they're shapeshifting, their intent is to be deceptive. That's where the issue lies. Now, it's like I've had, you know, the foots come up in the front yard, and I've told you about this before, and I had one that came in, and it looked like a deer, but it was like the size of an elk or a small moose. All right, I'm in South Carolina. We don't have those. And it was jet black. And it came in, and it walked up to my tree line, and then it stood on two legs, and it was getting eating some of the pine needles out of the pine trees. And I thought, this thing looks like it's 12 foot tall. Like, what in the world is going on? Until it shape-shifted into a Bigfoot. And then it walked over towards my porch, and it was sitting out by my porch. And then it walked over. I had in the middle of my front yard, I had a spot that I used to put birdseed down all the time. And it went to go over where the birdseed was, and it got over there, and it was eating the birdseed for I don't know how long. And then it shape-shifted down to a raccoon and ran out. I wasn't the only one that saw it. You know, I mean, the intent was to make somebody believe, and it wasn't a bad foot. I mean, he was nice. He was just scared. He was out in the open. He wasn't behind trees or anywhere where he was hiding. And so his intent was to be deceptive and not look like, you know, a Bigfoot, because he didn't want anybody to come after him because they're so afraid of what we do to them. So even though he was kind and he had a good soul, he was trying to be deceptive. He didn't want us to see what he truly was. So when you have something that has shape-shifted, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, and quite honestly, a lot of the shape-shifters are not altogether good, there's a difference in a true shape-shifter that can really cause a lot of harm and danger, and then some of these cryptids that shape-shift for safety. There's a difference. And so, but in all of it, if you are shape-shifting from your original form, it's still deceptive. It's still deceitful. You're trying to fool somebody, you know, and that's the intent of it.
Okay. All right. And then, of course, we have, there's several movies, and I also want to get these on this podcast so that as kind of a record. There are three movies in particular. Number one is the King Kong of it, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That is the King of the Shapeshifting movies. Where you know, these aliens come and they start taking over our bodies and start looking like us, and they get rid of us, so they're shape shifting into us. Number one. And then there is also They Live, starring Roddy Piper, and the wrestler Roddy Piper, and he's, you know, these people get on television, and he puts on these special glasses and he sees them as they really are, which are reptilians. And that's a huge part of popular culture. That was an immensely popular movie in the late 80s, and it's still quite popular with a lot of people. And then there's one that a lot of people have not seen called Society. And it's about all these very wealthy people that get together and have a party, and they invite three rather poor but very nice people, and they shapeshift into slimy monsters and start eating them. And, you know, it's just shapeshifting is a little bit of our movie-going culture. It really is. And, you know, I don't think it's exactly the way they portray it, but those are three interesting films. Society, They Live, and, of course, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And Invasion of the Body Snatchers has gone through, I believe, three incarnations. It's a really good film. And so, you know, everybody watch those if you can. I think they're good shape-shifting movies. But the real idea, and I wanted Isaiah Grass. We're going to have Isaiah Grass back on the show here soon. Isaiah's a great guy, the entertainer from American Idol. But anyway, Elijah, I asked him to talk about shapeshifters. And now, Elijah, isn't it possible that the Werewolf Springs story, that those things are shapeshifters? Is that possible?
I've never heard it told that way, to be honest with you. Every rendition I've ever heard seems to describe a physical creature of some sort. I don't know that I've ever heard anything connected to it that was connected to shape-shifting. For example, the story itself starts with a creature that is caged on a boxcar and that train derails. It's a circus train carrying a bunch of boxcars of animals for their circus, and that beast was on one of the boxcars. So I can't say that I've ever heard anything that could connect any sort of werewolfery or shape-shift into the beast of Werewolf Springs, so to speak. But do you mind if I make a quick comment on intention like you were talking about earlier?
Please do.
Well, I do believe there's something, absolutely something to the power of intention, you know, whether it's natural or supernatural. You know, the government actually used to use intention. They were studying it as a weapon. I forget the year, but if you're familiar with the men who stare at goats, they were using it, studying it to as a weapon. They would lock eyes with a goat or focus on a goat, and their intention was for its heart to explode. They would think toward it that its heart would explode, and it would. General Stubblebine actually came out and talked about these things and said it was a very real thing. He would say, I would look to the goat, I would think that I wanted its heart to explode, and it would, but I couldn't just think that it would explode. I had to believe it. So it was the combination of belief, and it was the combination of his intention, what he wanted to happen to that goat. And, you know, if you want to go a little bit further, I don't know if this connects to it at all, but thought does affect the world around us. I think his name was Masaru Emoto, he did a study on water. He took these little jars of water, and on one, he put a piece of tape, and he wrote hate on it or bad, you know, some sort of a negative phrase. And then he would take a jar and write a positive phrase like love or God or goodness, and he'd freeze those. And then he'd take a microscope and he'd look at the frozen crystals, the ice crystals inside of it, and the ones that had a negative phrase on it, the ice crystals were distorted, they were ugly, they had no shape to them, they were disorganized. But when he'd look at the ice crystals formed by the good intention that was put on them, it was beautiful, just artistic, snowflake-like structures, just beautiful structures. And they would even do this with rice. One jar of rice would have a negative phrase. One jar would have either no phrase on it at all, or it would have kind of a neutral phrase. And one would have something good on it. And the jar with the negative phrase, the rice started to rot inside of it after a little while. The middle jar, I forget exactly what happened to it, but it didn't just rot. Something else happened to it. But I think it was the jar that was with the good phrase, it turned to sake. And, you know, they would sometimes direct their thoughts toward these jars of water, and they'd get the good crystals. You know, they'd pray, they'd try all sorts of things. So their thoughts, their feelings about the world around them, it certainly did affect the world around them. Now, if we focus an intent of something negative on somebody, is our brain waves affecting the water in that person's body? Is it causing a reaction, you know, slowly killing them or something of that nature? When we think something good, can it heal them? I recall hearing stories before that somebody may have been sick with a tumor or something like that. They'd lay down and they just imagine that, for example, they would imagine little elves just going in and they'd visualize those little elves taking like a pickaxe and just chopping away that tumor. And they do this over and over every day. And they went back to the doctor and they were in remission. They started healing. The tumor was disappearing. And I forget all the details on this, but there's actually this book that I'm reading right now. It's called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. Very interesting book. It was saying something to the effect of a scientific study was done with jars of DNA. When people would focus negative thoughts and combined with an emotional factor, like they, I'm not really sure how to describe it. You possibly could describe it as either belief or just there's an emotional response combined with the intent. The DNA would start to unwind, it would start to die, so to speak. And but that would happen, I guess, when they had a positive. So
there. You there, Elijah? Are you there? Well, I guess if everyone can hear me, I guess Elijah will return. He might have lost some signal because I know he does live out in the woods. Dr. Trey Dunaway, I was going to ask Trey a question, if I may. Dr. Trey, I know that not every cancer goes into remission, but I am certain that you, I'm guessing that you have heard of some what might call be called miracle cures as opposed to what, cures that don't happen. Is that correct?
Well, yes. There certainly have been reports of that. But you really need to know a lot of the details that usually don't surface when you have anecdotal. So most of my professional experience with cancer has not involved any miracle cures. Not to say it couldn't happen.
Okay, and I'm listen. I think I'm
I wouldn't be banking on the miracle cure. I think I'd go with the best that can be done with current medicine technology, rather than try to find something that is not backed up by proper scientific investigatory.
Right. If you got a kid with cancer, get him to St. Jude's. Correct.
Yeah, unless you don't want him to survive.
Right. You try to get him to St. Jude's.
There's nothing wrong with any folk medicine as long as it doesn't hurt the kid, or the power of prayer, or positive thinking, or all of these things. But cancer will kill you. And you don't want to go screwing with it. And you want to get the best that modern science can address. And if you have other things you want to add to it, as long as it doesn't interfere with therapies that are working, more power to you.
Right. I think you put that very well, and I'm sorry. I think I unfairly put you on the spot, and I want to apologize.
That doesn't put me on the spot, John. It doesn't put me on the spot, but it is important to know that when you hear of a story, but you're not sure on the details, and you know, it could have been this or it might have been that, and you don't really have the details. Without the details, it is a tall tale until proven otherwise.
Okay. All right. Very good. And again, if it seemed though I really was trying to put you on the spot, I wasn't. It seemed like a good question to follow up, and I'll say maybe it wasn't. So I will say that.
It's a good question. Lots of people believe that. And you know, the thing about this is that when you look at all the quackery in this century as well as in previous centuries, there are self-serving opportunists who will take advantage of people. And people believe what they want or choose to believe. And if somebody believes something that is just totally wacko, it's not that they're necessarily stupid, but rather they're desperate for a solution to whatever they're searching a solution for. So it's important to people are free to make their own choices. But I did see a great image. It shows a headstone, and it said, "I did my own research." So just be cautious with that.
And then I think the most unfortunate story of quackery is the Andy Kaufman story when he went to the Philippines and found out that those so-called folk surgeons were not surgeons at all, and Andy Kaufman died of cancer. And it was so sad. It was, he was a great comedian, great actor. His effect on wrestling with Jerry Lawler was absolutely incredible. He was one of the most popular men on the planet for a while, and unfortunately he was convinced that something was going to heal him, and it was nothing but pure pure sleight of hand and quackery, and it's just a shame.
As a Western trained physician, we are trained to be kind of skeptical of old wives' tales. However, when you look at the I mentioned before the call, I was talking a little bit about smallpox in the 18th century. And in the early part of the 18th century, reports came out from Turkey and Greece that the locals in those parts of the world, when the world was very large, it's much smaller now, and with the internet it's even less large, but reports came out about something called what they called inoculation or engrafting, where people would intentionally give other people smallpox, but not in a respiratory transmission, but in through skin scratches. And these reports were finally reported by fellows of the Royal College or Royal Society, which was like the premier scientific organization in the early 18th century. And it was published accordingly, but it was also published with a bunch of other stuff, and it was written off as old wives' tales. Well, after some personal witnessing by people that were trained and brought England, and through that same transmission from proceedings of the Royal Society, it made its way across the pond to the colonies, and that system of engrafting, where you take smallpox and you directly apply it to skin. This is not a vaccine. This is called a variolation, because the patient really did get smallpox, so it wasn't a vaccine. But the mortality with that technique was significantly less than that if you picked it up naturally. So here is an example of an old wives' tale that was thoroughly dismissed, but with real investigation and real clinical trials, as good as you can get a clinical trial in the 18th century, there showed there was a real advantage to this. But even though an advantage was proven, it never really caught on until much later in the century. But the numbers that were as a result of population studies, as best they could in the 18th century, proved that it was an effective therapy. So sometimes you might have a therapy that you don't believe right off, but it deserves a good shake. Otherwise, you do end up with people being talked into ivermectin or witchcraft or charlatans who are willing to take your money, but they're not willing to put up real data to show results and don't publish and don't get peer reviewed. So that's where I'll leave it.
Okay. And so basically you're saying what a lot of us believe is there's no substitute for science in really investigating something, period.
Right.
Whatever it is, let's investigate it. And I see too many skeptics just saying, well, it's not real, it doesn't work, or attacking the person. Instead of investigating, because investigation is the only thing that's going to get us closer to the truth. And I'll bet you agree with that, don't you, Dr. Trey?
I do.
Absolutely. Well, good. Well, look, thanks for being our Surgeon General. Now, Robin had something to say before I went to you. So, Robin, what were you going to say?
I kind of want to back up to the whole shape-shifting thing.
Okay.
Because I agree that things can go from their natural state and shape-shift into another. I believe that 100%. I've seen it happen. But when it comes to the ETs, yes, they can shape-shift, but there's a difference between shape-shifting and taking possession, okay? Like, if they're going to shape-shift, they're still their soul. They're still their what they are. They've changed their outward appearance. When they take possession, they remove your soul and they go in, they take their soul and it goes into your body. That's completely different than a shapeshift. And when we were talking earlier, it kind of got glumped into one thing. And the only reason that I know about that at all, and it doesn't mean I'm an expert because, you know, I don't believe in that, but is because I was contacted well over a year ago and told by a good group of ETs how it was being done because they wanted people to be aware of it because the bad ETs were doing it. Okay, so like when something is shape-shifting, they are transforming their physical appearance into whatever they want to shape-shift to. But when, like per se, the ETs take over a body, they are literally removing the soul of that person and putting their essence and their soul, whatever it is, whether they have a soul or not, but they're putting themselves inside of it. So it's almost like they're wearing a Halloween costume. That is not shape-shifting. That's possession. So there really is a difference.
Okay. All right. And this leads me, and I've got a question for Robin. And then I'm gonna go to Elijah. So Robin, how would you characterize Travis Walton? Fire in the sky, Travis Walton, the guy that saw the UFO, went up, came down, had the life-changing experience. How would you characterize the Travis Walton experience?
Travis never shape-shifted. He was given alien DNA to save his life. So genetically, he would have that within him. That's part of who he is now. That's not a possession or a shapeshift.
Okay. I think I always wanted to bring up Travis Walton on the show, so I did. Okay.
Yeah, no, he's neither. They haven't taken possession of him. They have not removed Travis from his body and implanted a ET there. That he's still Travis. From my understanding of what I know of the situation, when I spoke to Travis, and he didn't give me the information up front. I went to him and I said, they did this, didn't they? And he said, well, how did you know that? I said, I just do, and that's what they did. And he said, yes. And basically what they did in order to save him is they gave him DNA. Because if not, he would have died. They saved his life. I don't believe that they were bad ones that had him. I think it was a situation that happened, and it was unfortunate. But if it wasn't for them, he would have died. And he didn't shapeshift into anything. He stayed Travis. He didn't lose his form. He didn't look at, like, something different. But like I said, there is a huge difference in something changing their physical form because they are taking their physical being and morphing into something else. And there's a big difference in that and having a shell of a human or a shell of anything and then something else climbing inside that shell. I mean, I guess that's the best way I can think of to explain it. There's a big difference. It's not even close to the same thing. That's why the ETs got hold of me that time and said, listen, you have to warn people because the bad ETs do this. At the process that they start, you know, when you're born, they choose who they're going to do this to, and this is what they do. And they went through the whole thing. But regardless, that's completely different than shape-shifting. A shape-shifter changes shape. That's why they call it shape-shifting. They're changing the shape of their body, of their face, of everything about them, but they're still the same inside as what they were before. That doesn't change. Only the outward appearance changes. Where the other one, when they insert something into someone else's body or whatever, that's a possession. That's different.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. Well, now, Elijah, you're back with us,
yes,
right?
Sir. Can you hear me?
That's right. Absolutely, we can. And what I'd like to do, and it might be, you can take all the time you want. I would like for you to have the last word on tonight's discussion. We have hit so many incredible topics because you started us off with shapeshifters. So how would you like to conclude this incredible exercise before everybody gets to say goodnight?
Maybe so. What you got for me, brother?
No, it's up to you. What have you got to say in conclusion to all this commentary?
Well, I think we've had a pretty interesting chat tonight. You know, you can't beat the power of intention if, you know, whatever science is there. And the discussion of shapeshifters is very interesting. I think we've hit along a lot of really interesting topics tonight. You know, there's a lot of shapeshifting stories. There's a lot of power of intention stories out there, whether they're connected. I don't know who can rightly say that on this side of heaven. But definitely something strange going on out there. Now, I have a few things more on the matter of shapeshifting. I can tell you if that's something you'd like to hear. It's just
sure,
up to
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Well, I do want to mention that Elon Musk recently said in an interview that, and this is on the scientific level, he said that the mRNA, that if we adjust that, you know, with the right, I think, RNA sequence, he said that we could turn someone into a freaking butterfly if we wanted to, if we have the right, you know, RNA sequence. Now, that's on the scientific level. If somebody could do that, what could be done on the spiritual level? What can something of a demonic nature do?
I don't know.
And we know historically there's always been stories of Native American skinwalkers. You know, I've heard stories of people turning into birds before people's very eyes. I heard a story from overseas of a missionary that was doing missionary work, and this baboon kept coming in to his house every night, trashing the place, you know, wrecking things, and it'd leave on a nightly basis. This baboon would keep coming back, and it'd just keep wrecking the place. And eventually, they shot this baboon while it was coming back, And when they shot and killed it, it transformed back into a man. So, I mean, there's a lot of things going on, not just with potential werewolves or shapeshifting into Bigfoot. Sounds like through supernatural agencies, people can transform to anything they want to. And with that being said, if somebody could shapeshift into an animal, could they shapeshift into another person? Could they steal somebody's identity? Could they turn into Elijah Henderson and go rob a bank somewhere, you know, get me in prison for life? There's a lot of interesting doors you could open with a discussion on shapeshifting. And then you could open the doors to sightings of doppelgangers people have seen, you know, doppelgangers of themselves or their family members walking through other rooms. You know, I've read about families sitting in their living room and say the mom was out in town for the day. They'd see mom walking through the hallway and it'd freak them out. They'd go to the other room where she went, nobody there. And then mom would come home a few hours later. You know, there's a lot of identity theft in a way, you know.
Steve Dills, who's been in our show three times, told a story about a doppelganger, is that he and a couple of his guys that did paranormal investigations, they were in the old Richmond Tavern, and they saw one of their buddies come walking through. He didn't even act like he noticed that they were there. They spoke to him. He didn't even look. He just went walking on into a room, and then they went to the room, and he was gone. So they called up his cell phone, and he was like 4 hours away. And they saw this example of a doppelganger. They saw it. And Steve's a pretty normal guy, and he had four witnesses. So, yes, there are doppelgangers. I mean, there are things that we can't explain. And I just say pray and hope nothing bad happens to you. All right, we're going to ask Robin for her final thoughts and Dr. Trey with it. His final thoughts, then we're going to ride off into the sunset. I don't know that we could ever have a more interesting scary cast than we've had tonight. So, Robin, what are your final thoughts?
I just wanted to tell Elijah thank you because I think he brought some great information. It was very enjoyable. It was very interesting. It was very knowledgeable.
Thank you, Robin.
I really appreciate the amount of effort you go into the research for it. I really enjoyed it. I really and truly did.
Thanks for kind words, man.
No problem. Thank you. I mean it sincerely. And I feel like, you know, the information that I am aware of, which is not everything, I'm not aware of all the stuff that you know of, but it really coincides with what I've learned as well. So I like that aspect of it, too. So I just thought it was really impressive. Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Well, Robin, those are very kind words, and we certainly love what you bring to the table. You bring a lot, and thank you so much. And Dr. Trey, as long as we're still friends, as long as I didn't push you past the limit, would you give us the last word?
You didn't push me past any limit. I enjoyed it. It was an interesting discussion. And I'm glad I could be here.
Well, thank you very much. We were especially glad that everyone was here tonight. You're all really great friends of mine. And this was like just a very personal night of my friends talking about some of the most incredible topics. So we've got this recorded because I think it's certainly one of the more interesting scary casts we have ever had. So I want to say thank you so much to everybody. I'll have a book out someday in about 3 months. I might have the book Program the Brain come out in about a month. I'll be talking with every one of you tomorrow about tonight's show. I may have to go pass out from exhaustion. It was a rough day at work, but I wanted to say thank you to everybody. We've had another legendary scary cast, and don't think it can get any better than this. So thanks a lot to everybody. And everybody say good night.
Have a good night, y'all.
Good night.